Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's April 21st, 2015 8th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 1, Enforcement Trends and Issues. Mary Jo Gillette and Ivan Harris will discuss current and important enforcement trends and issues in the hedge fund industry. Now, on to the podcast.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Ivan Harris, and with me is Mary Jo Gillette. We are partners in our securities enforcement practice, and we're here to start the presentation today with, enforcement trends and issues. So the topics we're going to cover today, we'll go over some enforcement priorities in the current enforcement environment within the SEC and its enforcement staff. We'll spend some time discussing some recent cases that involve private funds that have come out of the SEC, and in particular its asset management unit over the last year. We'll discuss some predictions for 2015. No presentation like this can really start with anything other than a discussion of the SEC's asset management unit, which is the primary unit within the Division of Enforcement that's responsible for cases involving investment advisors and where the trends and where the priorities for the SEC's enforcement program are really set. The AMU turned 5 years old this year. It is the largest of the SEC's specialized units within the Division of Enforcement. It has 75 staff, including 7 industry experts, which they really take pride in. These are primarily non-lawyers, but some of them are lawyers who came out of the industry, are tasked with helping the lawyers in the asset management unit develop their cases, understand where issues are in the private fund industry. And they have an enormous impact on how the SEC investigates their cases within the asset management unit. They have a strong desire to bring groundbreaking cases within the AMU. What we're talking about today, conflicts of interest, related party transactions, policies and procedures. And although the real groundbreaking portion of that case was the SEC's first ever case under Rule 38A1 under the Investment Company Act, which for the most part isn't going to apply to the private funds that are here, a straightforward breach of fiduciary duty Rule 206 violation and failure to have policies and procedures regarding outside activities that could potentially raise a conflict of interest. So we'll weave some of the themes into our discussion today, but it's another example of how when they say they're going to be bringing first of its kind cases and groundbreaking cases, they do intend to follow through on that promise. And then finally, for the asset management unit, it's not unusual at all to find enforcement attorneys from the asset management unit on exams. But again, that's an effort for those attorneys and those enforcement investigators in the asset management unit to get in on the ground floor of cases before they develop out of the exam program. And it shows their interest in making sure that they keep abreast of issues that are coming up and take as wide a view as they can of the industry and not just through the narrow lens of enforcement cases that they eventually investigate and bring. And Mary Jo, you want to talk a little bit about the very challenging current enforcement environment?
Of course. The SEC's Division of Enforcement has only become increasingly aggressive, both in the types of charging decisions that they are making, in the demands that they're making for settlement to resolve enforcement matters, and from a policy and programmatic standpoint in terms of how they are thinking not just about your case, if you happen to be that unlucky firm or individual, but about where that fits into the larger programmatic agenda. I'm just going to touch on a couple of things that really are increasingly changing this landscape, and you will also hear references to this theme throughout our presentation. First of all, the SEC's Enforcement Division brought 755 new enforcement actions in fiscal year 2014. That's the greatest number they've brought to date by 20 over the next highest year. Recognize that that number does not mean that they sued 755 people. A single enforcement action might have multiple defendants in it, so those are 755 separate proceedings. Along the lines of settlement, increasingly it is becoming more difficult to find ways to resolve matters at the settlement phase or early in the process through a settlement. Some of the factors that are playing into that, the division's requirement that in some instances they will require admissions of sorts by defendants or respondents in or as a condition of settlement. In fiscal year 2014, there were approximately a dozen cases in which they required admissions. This new approach was announced in 2013, and total, there have only been 14 enforcement matters where they've required admissions. Nonetheless, at the time that they announced the policy, they announced criteria that they were going to look to in determining what types of cases would require admissions. I can tell you that if you do an analysis of the 14 that are out there, it's impossible to make any rhyme nor reason of what the criteria were, and they certainly do not all fit within the criteria that have been announced. I think probably the most important takeaway from this piece is that the staff has an internal policy that the decision about whether an admission will be required or not will be made within the division, and that once that decision is made, it's not going to be negotiable. What does that mean for those who are on the receiving end of an SEC inquiry? It means that if you are in an investigation and it looks like it's not going well, you need to find a way to signal to the staff very early in that process, way before they're talking to you about charges or a Wells notice, that it would be impossible for you to settle with admissions. And the reason is because once that decision is made, it's almost impossible to unwind. But if they know that early on, they then have the opportunity to begin thinking creatively about what types of violations they might charge, how they might frame the case effectively in a way that would then not require admissions. And we all know that the same conduct can be packaged in multiple ways. If you wait too late, too early is not good either, because you might give them an idea they didn't have. So judgment is really important in terms of who to charge, but waiting too late can really be fatal. Other factors that are weighing against the ability to quickly resolve matters are the renewed emphasis on bringing charges against individuals. Much more difficult to settle those cases for all the obvious reasons. The announced desire to and willingness to take matters all the way to the mat in terms of litigation on the part of the SEC, and in conjunction with that, this programmatic decision to move a higher percentage of litigated matters into the administrative forum and out of the district courts, which has implications procedurally in terms of the amount of discovery, for example, that's available to respondents and defendants, and the time that it's going to take from filing of the action until a sanction is imposed. It's much more compressed in the administrative forum. The other thing I'll just touch on, because it's sort of new territory, but I won't spend a lot of time, is the SEC's whistleblower program. 2014 completed the fourth year. In 2014, the Office of the Whistleblower received over 3,600 tips, complaints, and referrals from members of the public all over the world, frankly. They considered issued 16 orders for paying out awards to whistleblowers during fiscal 2014, but 9 of those denied awards. They still have only done a total of 14 awards under the whole program. So the one they have them, and they've had some big dollar ones, they get a lot of press, but in the context of the overall program, it's still sort of in the early phases. The one other thing I just want to mention is that the SEC in 2014 exercised the authority granted to it to sanction firms for what it perceived to be retaliation against whistleblowers. In the case, they recited those and made findings that there had been a violation. It was not particularly helpful because there were also other underlying substantive securities law violations in that matter, and they did not break out what portion of the penalty amount, which was $300,000, went to the retaliation More recently, earlier this month, they brought a case against a public company, really attacking them for the language that they had in their confidentiality agreement that the SEC found had a chilling effect on whistleblowers coming forward after they signed this. So I think you're really seeing the law move, and it creates new risks and concerns for firms. I personally think that that case went further than it needed to, and it will be interesting to see where the law develops going forward.
Yeah, and the question that we're getting a lot now is that there was a lot of attention paid to confidentiality terms in separation agreements. That one concerned confidentiality terms in internal investigation procedures. So when doing an internal investigation, they required the employees who participated in that investigation to sign a confidentiality agreement. The tension there is, for those of you who have ever participated in an internal investigation, the lawyers always give the witnesses what's called an Upjohn warning, telling them that the discussion is subject to the attorney-client privilege, that it's the company's privilege, and that only the company can decide whether to disclose the information that is covered in the interview of the employee. So people are starting to think about, do we need to change that standard Upjohn language, which has been the same for many, many years since the Supreme Court came out with the Upjohn case, to tell employees that what you learn in this discussion is subject to the attorney-client privilege. What we discuss in this session is subject to the attorney-client privilege, that only the company controls that privilege and decides whether that privilege can be waived. Anything you know, independently of this discussion, independently of this meeting, is not covered by that privilege or is not covered by that warning, so that you don't potentially run afoul of what the SEC was saying. It's an unclear issue, but something that people are starting to think about in the context of conducting internal investigations and giving warnings to employees who are interviewed in those.
And this, if you're looking at this issue or thinking about it, it's worth pulling the case and reading the language of what they had in their confidentiality agreement and the undertaking that the SEC required them to take and the language that they now are required to put in their agreement going forward, which reads almost like an invitation to go to the government and tell them what you know. It is very, very heavy-handed. They also were required, as one part of the sanction, to make a reasonable effort to find every employee who had ever signed the prior confidentiality agreement language going back to 2011 and serve on them a copy of the SEC's order. So the monetary amount was a $130,000 penalty, so as penalties go, not exorbitant, but the undertaking was pretty invasive.
Quickly, just some priorities for 2015, and we'll go through this relatively quickly because it's covered in a lot of the cases we talk about. But Julie Rui, who's the co-head of the asset management unit, gave a speech in February that, if you haven't read it, you should take a read through. But she outlined the priorities for the asset management unit in 2015. They include, no surprise, conflicts of interest, which we'll see in some of the cases, valuation issues, which come up in one of the cases that came out last year, and compliance and control systems and procedures. Undisclosed fees, we've seen a couple of cases involving expense allocation, but what they're really targeting for next year are the types of fees you see in private equity firms, monitoring fees, broken deal expenses, and payments to affiliates. We discussed some of these last year. We still haven't seen the cases, but they promise they're coming this year. And related party transactions, another issue that we'll talk about in some of the cases.
Continuing on the same theme from Julie's speech, she said that one of their priorities this year will be valuation issues. Again, it's been an issue and a priority in the past. It will continue forward, and particularly for illiquid investments portfolio companies. Suspicious performance, again, an extension of the aberrational performance initiative that started several years ago. And then looking at the adequacy of compliance programs and controls, and we'll talk about some cases that have started that already. One of the interesting things that I think she said in that speech, which underscores a theme that you're going to hear throughout this program, is that she referred to the Office of Compliance Inspections and Examinations, or OC, the Asset Management Unit in Enforcement, and the Division of Investment Management as a three-legged stool working together to take a look at industry practices that may need to be addressed. And they are working closely together, bolstered by the Division of Economic Risk and Analytics.
Okay, so let's take a look at some of the lessons we can learn from the cases that the SEC brought in its fiscal year 2014 and in the first couple of months of 2015. Starting with a couple of cases on conflicts of interest. A lot of you are probably familiar with the case, which was one in which a private equity firm owned two portfolio companies in two different private equity funds and made those acquisitions because of the synergies that owning those two companies could bring. They shared expenses, they shared administrative services, they shared a lot of kind of back office type functions, and although some of the fees and expenses associated with those functions were allocated fairly between the two private equity funds that owned those two different companies, some were not, which resulted in one fund paying more than its pro rata share of those expenses than the other fund, therefore to the detriment of the investors in that fund and to the benefit of the investors in the other fund. It was also sanctioned for failing to have policies and procedures regarding the allocation of its expenses and how it would monitor those. One of the interesting things about that is that most of the conduct in that case occurred before they were registered as an investment advisor. And so what it was sanctioned for is once it became an investment advisor and then was subject to the requirement to have policies and procedures and controls, it did not adopt sufficient policies and procedures. So it emphasizes for a lot of funds that have recently registered as a result of Dodd-Frank to take a look at what you're doing and make sure that your policies and procedures match that conduct. Another conflicts case is structured portfolio management. This has to do with side-by-side management. A portfolio manager was purchasing the same securities, treasuries, for two different funds, one pursuant to a hedge strategy and one for an investment strategy. And the fund had insufficient policies and procedures to monitor the fair allocation of those opportunities between the funds, particularly in light of evidence pursuant to best execution reviews that one fund was consistently receiving better execution. One thing that the SEC has focused on in a couple of cases that have come out this year, and it's been a little bit surprising, is, as we reference here in the second bullet, unqualified staff. The SEC's case in structured portfolio management continually referred to the fact that a junior compliance officer was responsible for monitoring this conflict and was ill-equipped to do so. So when you're looking at your staffing, not only in terms of numbers, you also have to look at the qualifications of that staff to make sure that they are capable of doing what they're doing, and the SEC expects that. The other issue on this side-by-side case was that the SEC stressed that the importance of allocation at the time of execution, and that this fund had poor controls for ensuring that investment opportunities were allocated at the time of execution and gave too much discretion to the portfolio manager to change that after execution. And then as we mentioned, the case from yesterday comes into play when talking about the conflicts of interest. Take a look through that. It's a case where a portfolio manager was investing fund and separately managed account assets into a company that he was affiliated with. It emphasizes the importance of monitoring outside business activities and having controls regarding outside business activities of advisory personnel. And the SEC kind of closed with this line regarding conflicts of interest in the case, and it's really what their view is. It is the client, not the investment advisor, who is entitled to determine whether a conflict of interest might cause a portfolio manager, consciously or unconsciously, to render advice that is not disinterested. So they're really emphasizing disclosure of conflicts to clients in the private fund area, to, if it's not the fund itself, then to the investors in the fund or some kind of committee of investors in the fund, and that's where they expect the disclosure to be made. Quickly, a note about an interesting case involving misrepresentations in connection with CDO liquidations. This is a case, and although it was against a broker-dealer and its principal for acting as CDO liquidation agent and secretly arranging to provide the best bid in connection with CDO liquidations, it does point to the possibility that a fund could run into the same trouble. These investment opportunities were acquired by the liquidation agent and then placed into the fund that was affiliated with that liquidation agent. And the SEC alleged that by doing so, the liquidation agent violated the representations it made to the trustee in connection with those liquidations to the benefit of its fund. Also to the benefit of the liquidation agent because they got better bids on those, to the CDO, because they got better bids on the liquidations. But nevertheless, the misrepresentations resulted in a fraud finding. The other part of the case was that the broker was charged with providing color to a bidder to allow them to reduce their bid for a security that was being liquidated to the detriment of the trustee and to the CDO. And so you should read the case to get a sense of kind of where you might draw the line if you're acting in that capacity between providing color to a bidder versus providing information that might result in harm to the CDO or the trustee in connection with that kind of a transaction.
With regard to valuation, earlier, at the end of March, the SEC filed an administrative proceeding. This is not a settled matter. It is in litigation currently. It rested on what the SEC determined, in its view, were the improper valuation of loans held by CLO funds. And the allegation is that the valuation of the loans was based upon the manager's subjective decision of when to stop supporting the portfolio company instead of the objective factors that were listed in the indentures. The point at the end of the day from the SEC's standpoint on this is that by doing so, the CLOs avoided triggering their over-collateralization tests and therefore permitted the affiliates to continue collecting fees. It is being fiercely fought. Currently, they have filed a proceeding to challenge the constitutionality of the SEC's administrative process, but I suspect that it will be a fiercely fought piece of litigation, so you can keep an eye on that. The next one, misappropriation. Misappropriation is pretty basic. Portfolio manager who took out excess fees for personal expenses. This is West End Capital Management. The important thing we want to bring to your attention with regard to this case is that this was discovered during an SEC exam, and even though the fund terminated the portfolio manager and reimbursed the fund for the misappropriated funds, the SEC still brought an enforcement action against them for lack of internal controls, and they were required to pay a $150,000 penalty. Along the compliance program and procedures, more along that theme, was based on a failure to disclose and obtain consent from clients regarding principal transactions that were done through an affiliated broker-dealer. Effectively, what was happening was the broker-dealer was purchasing fixed income securities from other broker-dealers and then selling them at a higher price to clients. Besides the fact that it wasn't disclosed and they didn't have consent, they also were charged with failing to seek best ex by routing these transactions to the broker-dealer. They also were charged with false performance advertising. To give you an idea, they had to pay over $360,000 in disgorgement. Penalty against the firm was $200,000, and against the CEO, who had previously for a period also served as the chief compliance officer, a $50,000 penalty against him individually. This case was just a failure to adhere to the custody rule. This is also being fought and is in open litigation, and the most recent thing I could find on that was an entry of an order by the administrative law judge on April 17th. Disqualifying the defense counsel, so stay tuned for where that's going. In terms of predictions, pretty much everything you would expect. I would say shorthand, more of the same. You've seen sort of some teasers at the end of 2014. I think you'll continue to see focus on valuation, and Julie Riev, again in her speech in February of this year, said that they would be particularly focusing on the use of friendly broker marks in this regard. She also specifically spoke about the fact that they are continue to refine their analytics in connection with the aberrational performance inquiry. In 2014, they brought the eighth case that was generated by the aberrational performance inquiry, which started several years back, and they used data analytics to try to identify firms through algorithms that are written by DIRA, this division that they have, whose performance seems to be an outlier as compared to its peers based upon, you know, a number of variables that would define the peer group. Continue to have very heavy focus on undisclosed conflicts, and particularly with regard to related party transactions. And I think we will continue to see this sort of broken windows approach. Broken windows approach announced by Mary Jo White in October of 2013, no violation too small. In fiscal year 2014, some examples of that were the focus on sort of compliance-related and repeat offender type violations, relatively small in the scheme of things, more Rule 105 cases, and a number of matters brought against both firms and individuals for failure to timely report transactions and holdings.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
To listen to other panels from the 2015 8th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.